Morning, ladies and gentlemen.
This is the time for on bank rehearing in the case of Kincaid versus Vincent Andrews et al. Judge Gould is with us by telephone from Seattle. Judge Gould, are you here?
Yes, I'm here.
Can you hear?
I can hear you perfectly.
Very well. Then we may proceed.
Good morning. I'm Neil Papiano, and I represent Mr. Pincai and Mr. McCarron.
Good morning.
If I may, for just a moment, I'd like to do just a bit of background because I think it's significant. As you probably know, this case was filed 15 years ago. It was filed with respect to some money that was taken from these two jockeys. They're both renowned jockeys, the number one and number three jockeys in the world. Since that time, they have not received any of their money back. They have received judgments, and they have both retired, both because of injuries. Money still has not been returned. With respect to the facts of the case and where we are.
How do we know this is true, what you just told us?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
How do we know this is in the record?
No, it is not in the record.
So you're making a jury argument here or based on extra records?
That isn't part of the argument, it's just part of the background.
Oh.
So
and we have to consider it in deciding our case? These facts that are not on the record, we don't know are true?
I'm sorry,
We have to consider these facts that are not in the record, and we don't know what to, or we're supposed to consider them?
Particularly.
You're just telling us things, you're using up your time at the argument, telling us things.
I understand. The significance is only that the case is not new. It's been here 15 years. It's been up twice.
That's a matter of record. What your clients are now doing, whether they're injured, whether they're retired, and all that, is just something you're bringing in. To the sort of influence.
Just for background.
Mr. Papillon, why don't you proceed?
Just for background. With respect to the situation, these are very experienced lawyers, as we all know. This is alleged to be a mistake by these very experienced lawyers with respect to a very, very clear Rule 4. The rule could not be more
clear. I'm sorry,
clear.
You don't think it's a mistake?
Pardon
you
me?
Say it's alleged to be a mistake. You say it's alleged to be a mistake. Are you saying it's not a mistake? I thought the district court found, the district court was a tire of fact, found it was a mistake. So when you say alleged, what do you mean by that?
The district court did say that.
Okay. And the district court had a record on which it could find the mistake.
I think not, Your Honor. I'm not sure it had any record.
You think there's that a district court should have found this was deliberate? They waited 60 days.
The district court,
knowing it was supposed to be 30 days, is that what you're saying?
Yes, the district court had The district court had before it the affidavit or declaration of one of the parties sitting here.
And that's all it had, and it made a finding, and it wouldn't be much more useful for us to assume that those are the facts, because those are the facts that were found, and go on and discuss the legal issues.
Well, I'm not assuming that they are not the facts. I agree.
Well, you said alleged. You said alleged, which suggests to me that you are challenging that, and if you are challenging it, I think we need to talk about it.
I apologize for that. I'm not challenging that. I'm using...
This is not a jury, Mr. Papiano.
I guess I'm using a legal term.
An incorrect legal term.
The district court did find that, as a matter of fact, I believe, that one of the attorneys had assigned the determination with respect to how many days there were to file the appeal to a clerk, a non-attorney. I think that's a significant fact for you, and significant because it indicates that it was...
Counsel, I thought it was a little simpler than that. The lawyer handling the case was out of town. He called his office. The calendar clerk in the office said it's not due till such and such a date, which was wrong. And so the attorney thought he had until such and such a date. Now, that was the usual calendar clerk for the law. Is that right?
That's what I understand to be the facts as stated.
And you're saying that's always inexcusable as a matter of law when a lawyer does that?
Correct.
Why is it always inexcusable?
Particularly in this case.
Why is it always inexcusable as a matter of law?
Because with a situation in which a law is involved, I think we probably all know that to assign that to a non-lawyer, no matter what the excuse may be.
Well, suppose he hadn't done that. Suppose he had looked at the rule himself and made the same mistake. Would that be different?
But the lawyer,
he had looked at the rule himself, but
I think not.
His eyes glazed over and he did notice that the 60-day thing said.
No, I think not. I think it would not be a lesser mistake, but this compounds the mistake. We have here a very clear. So this isn't the case as in Pioneer, where it was somewhat fuzzy as to what was meant by certain words. Here you have a very clear rule that we all know about.
Well, that cuts against your argument, doesn't it? If the lawyer delegates something to a subordinate, and the subordinate, because of lack of legal training, makes a mistake, then you could say, well, he shouldn't have delegated. But a lawyer and a paralegal can read 30 and 60 equally well. So this is not a situation where delegating it, the responsibility, somehow diminishes expertise on point.
Well,
right? So it seems to me the fact that it's a clear rule really hurts your argument.
Primary responsibility, I hope we can all agree, rests with the lawyer himself.
But you were answering Judge Berzon's question, which was, would it be different if the lawyer had made the mistake himself?
No.
It wouldn't be different. So we can cut the paralegal out of this. It's not really an issue.
You should, and I agree with that. That's exactly my point. It's the lawyer's problem, not the paralegal's problem.
When you say it's the lawyer's problem, I understand that to mean that the lawyer is liable in a malpractice action if it amounts to negligence with damages, regardless of whether the paralegal or the calendar clerk, rather than the lawyer, made the error. Because the person works for the lawyer.
Well, that presents a lot of other facts, but I assume that would be correct.
But I can't just see.
It depends on the facts.
I don't understand, and you already know I don't understand from the panel opinion.
I do indeed.
I don't understand why this particular area of delegation is special, and that's what I really want some explanation for. It seems to me, if anything, it's more defensible than, say, having a summer law clerk who is not yet admitted to the bar summarizing depositions for you, which many lawyers and large firms do.
Very significant differences, and many lawyers and large firms do that. But in summarizing a deposition, you don't make legal decisions.
Well, you make what may be critical decisions for the client about what the lawyer in charge of the litigation needs to know about what the witness said.
Well, even in those instances, if there is any doubt, it's the lawyer's responsibility to read the deposition. And in this case,
when you say responsibility, that's where I keep getting lost.
Mr. Papillon, let me ask you a question in a slightly different way. Is there any case that you're aware of where the lawyer has delegated the legal question of how many days I have to appeal, as contrasted with saying we have 30 days to appeal to a paralegal or secretarial or administrative assistant who then screws up?
I'm not aware of any.
There's a difference in the degree of delegation, right?
Well, I don't think, if I may answer your question this way and then get back to it, I don't think that a lawyer can delegate a legal issue to a non-legal party and escape and use that as any excuse for any error of law.
Let me sort out two issues here on the calendaring error. Let's say the lawyer knows the deadline, and let's say the deadline is 30 days, and let's say the lawyer makes an error himself, actually a very common one. He just says, well, today is January 28th, so it's due February 28th. Or today is more, even more commonly, February 18th, so it's due March 18th. And he just miscounts days because February has 28 days or it has 29 days that year, or he forgets about a 31-day month. And instead of counting it out with his finger, he just adds a month to whatever day he's at. Inexcusable?
No, there is a case directly on that. And I can't remember the name of it, but if I look at my book here, I can find it. There is a case in which a lawyer miscounted the days as a 30-day or 31-day month and miscounted it. And the court said that that was excusable and allowed that to be filed. That's
which case was that now? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
If that's excusable, why isn't it excusable when you call your calendar clerk?
Well, there's a number of reasons here, if I may. First, this is not a one day. This is a 22-day situation. And this case has, as I said, been around for 15 years.
Well, doesn't the 15 years argue in favor of giving the trial judge the discretion to kind of know who's been naughty, who's been nice, you know, who deserves a break, assess the prejudice? I mean, doesn't the fact that this judge is intimately familiar with this case for 15 years suggest we ought to give some deference to the judge's discretion on this?
Well, I certainly hope it doesn't mean who's been naughty and who's been nice. But
I mean, he knows who's a goof-off and who isn't, who's been diligent, who hasn't.
I don't think this is a matter of goof-off, and I'm not making that accusation. I think this is a matter of what is the rule in a situation like this. And I think, as far as I could find, the only case that said you missed by a day, you're okay if you miscounted the month.
We know what the rule is because the Supreme Court told us in Pioneer. It says you do a balancing. That's what the rule is. The rule is you don't have a rule. You have a balancing of factors. And in response to Justice Sotomayor's question, why isn't the answer to that the judge does the balancing? And we review for abuse of discretion. The judge is more familiar with the parties, closer, can find facts, can find whether it's alleged error or maybe a deliberate omission or something. And then it balances, and then it comes to us, and we ask ourselves the question, was the judge drunk or crazy when he made that decision? And the answer is no. Then we're firm. Why isn't that the answer?
That gets into all of the problems of forgivable neglect, if there is such a thing. Is it really forgivable neglect to delegate?
It's not forgivable, much as the rule is excusable.
Excusable. Is it excusable neglect to do that? This case, the reason I mentioned that it had been up and down so many times, these same people, these same lawyers have had this case, and it has been up, and they didn't miss any previous filing dates. They knew the filing dates at those times. Would they forget it in between? Is that excusable?
But can't that also cut in their favor if they have always made their filing dates in the judge deciding who the judge believes in terms of why something occurred? And on an abuse of discretion standard. We don't know the parties. We didn't hear all of that. We're just reviewing the judge for abuse of discretion. Let's say the judge had gone your way went through the Pioneer factors and tweaking the record, but had found that it was not excusable. Wouldn't we be able to affirm it as well because the judge had gone through all those factors, seen the people, but had just made some credibility findings one way or the other?
Certainly you could have done that because that would have been in accordance with the cases and the law. The question is...
What you're asking us to do is, as a matter of law, say when this particular act occurs, that's it. You know, that there isn't a way, that you don't look to all of those factors and you don't, exercise your discretion.
Well, I don't think that there is a waiting in that sense. If you would, I'm sure that you're familiar with the treatise by Robert Stern, who was a member of the committee decided these rules, and he said in his treatise at 41 Fed Rules Decision.
All right, but that treatise has been just overcome by history, it seems to me, both by Pioneer and by the 2002 amendments and the comments to the 2000 amendments. I mean, we now know that excusable neglect doesn't mean something extraordinary and unusual, which is what his treatise said. It doesn't mean snow. It doesn't mean illness. It means neglect.
Well, but Pioneer, I don't believe Pioneer. I think Pioneer was a situation of confusion. The words used were not the customary words used by lawyers.
But at a more fundamental level, doesn't Pioneer say that there aren't any per se rules here? I mean, the real question in this case seems to be a legal question. Does Pioneer admit of per se rules, period?
I wasn't able to find anything in Pioneer that said there are no more per se rules. I'm not sure that that's a question that they're saying that there should be a weight of factors, that they're saying that there's no per se rule, and the fact that they said there was confusion. You can read to say that there are no per se rules, but I didn't think it was that strong.
Well, let me ask it a different way. Is there any circuit court that has said that a lawyer's misunderstanding of a clear rule is excusable neglect?
Yes, I think Pioneer said that, and I think that, and I think I can read that, inadvertence, ignorance of the rules or mistakes and construing the rules do not usually matter, because that's the dispositive word that I'm sure you focus on, do not usually constitute excusable neglect.
Okay, you haven't answered my question at all. That's what the Supreme Court says. They don't usually constitute excusable neglect.
And Kyle said the same thing.
And so that means they can, but not usually.
Right.
So then my question is, in circuit courts that have looked at this question where you had a clear rule, have any of them determined that a failure to understand a clear rule falls within this exception? In other words, maybe excusable neglect.
I think I've read most of the cases in that field. I can't remember one that said that.
Let me well be that the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 7th, 8th, and 11th circuits have all said that when a rule is clear and unambiguous, that one weights the Pioneer factors in heavily on the side of being inexcusable. And this court in Kyle, Yost, Grant, and Spicer has said the same thing. Or am I just reading those cases wrong?
This court in Kyle cited, as I'm sure you know, the Third Circuit Court in the Dominic Hess Oil case and set out 6 factors to be reviewed.
Well, Mr. Papagianni, do you have to make any argument in this case other than this was a clear rule? There's no ambiguity about it. There cannot be an excuse for misreading a clear, unambiguous rule. End of it.
I think that's right, although I think you can go beyond
that. If you made that argument, it would be wrong, wouldn't it?
No, I don't think so. I think it would not.
The Supreme Court clearly said, make mistakes. I mean, this is what you start with, the presupposition of a mistake, and then you balance. Then you look at other factors.
That is true.
And excuse can encompass many things. It doesn't excuse mean, oh, you have a good reason for it.
That is true.
It can also mean no harm, no foul. You understand that concept of excuse?
Well,
you know, you did something really horrible, totally stupid, but nothing came of it, so we're going to excuse it.
One of the reasons I brought up the fact that this case has been here for 15 years, this is not a no harm, no foul. This is
what the judge said, what the district judge said in the exercise of his discretion, is that your side lost nothing on account of his giving relief from the delay, except for a windfall gain on account of a few weeks.
And that's,
it wasn't the whole 12 years that they'd sat on their hands. It was a few weeks.
And that's always true, as several of the cases have said. It's always true in every case when there's a short extension. It's always true that you don't. It's not a severe prejudice.
Let me ask you about this. This one sentence in Pioneer. It says, the Supreme Court says, Congress plainly contemplated that the courts would be permitted, where appropriate, to accept late filings caused by inadvertence, mistake, or carelessness, as well as by intervening circumstances beyond the party's control. Now, that word carelessness is the one that attracts my attention, because they're just, carelessness means negligence. You're liable for malpractice if you make a careless mistake to your client's detriment. So I'm thinking, Congress here is saying, even where there isn't any good excuse, where it's just flat out careless, the district court still has the power to grant relief. And it seems to me that your argument is inconsistent with that sentence in Pioneer, and I'd like you to explain why I'm mistaken.
The district court, obviously, I think everybody can agree, the district court has the power, and as does as do other courts, but it has been consistently held that attorney's negligence is not usually, and that's why when
not
I
usually quote, means sometimes yes, usually
sometimes
no.
Under extraordinary circumstances, we have the case in which someone was in Africa and couldn't get back. I don't remember the name of that case, but it was.
That would be a beyond the party's control, so it wouldn't deal with the word carelessness.
It wouldn't deal with carelessness, but it would deal with an excuse, excusable neglect.
Carelessness is not excusable.
Well, what could be more careless than to assign when
but the Supreme Court says carelessness can be okay.
Well, under certain circumstances, I suppose that's right, but it depends on the facts of the situation. I think you have to look at the facts here.
Well, doesn't it matter that, I mean, he didn't ask the janitor for this advice. He didn't check with the waitress at Denny's. I mean, go to a tarot reader. You know, he called upon someone who would reasonably be expected to know the answer.
Well, the attorney himself should, an experienced attorney himself should know the answer.
Well, my question is why a paralegal should know the, or assistant should know the answer.
Assistant, not even a paralegal.
Well, these days there's not exactly a fine line between assistant, paralegal, whatever, executive, but lawyer. My question is, excusable for a lawyer when an assistant says the rule says X? Is it excusable for a lawyer to say, okay, I'll take that as a given, or does the lawyer have a responsibility himself or herself to read and understand the rule?
Certainly has that responsibility, and certainly does not is not able to say that a non-legal party can make that decision. But
let's give you that point.
Could we hear the answer?
Could I just answer for just 1 second? And you use the term in this day and age, and it takes probably less than a minute to go on the internet or to use your computer or to walk down the hall to see this rule. It is absolutely unambiguous. It is absolutely easy to find. This isn't something like in Pioneer where you. They used different words, and they could have been confusing, and he had multiple clients. This is not that case.
Well, let's suppose it's a computer program. It's a software calendaring package, and the attorney enters in the correct dates, and the software package spews out the wrong reminder.
Then I think you may have.
Why is that
then,
any?
Then I think you may have it.
Why is that any? Why is that any different from
because
this case?
Because here you're relying on. I think we all rely on the computer situation. Whether that would be absolutely excusable or not, we could argue that. And the reason we could argue it is because all of us can walk down the hall a few feet, pick up that book and look at it if
right.
we don't understand what
my question
is.
To you, sir,
it's a very easy thing to do.
My question to you, sir, is you could do that with a computer program, too. Let's say you understand it. And you could say, well, sure, you should mechanically count it out as well.
Of course,
so,
you're right. And I could, I'm pointing out that there are several ways to do this, including walking down the hall, including using a computer that would normally be far more reliable than relying on, and particularly an experienced trial and appellate lawyer, to be much more reliable than relying on a non-legal assistant.
But I'm not sure what any of that gets you. I mean, the lawyer goes down the hall, he reads the rule, he can make the same mistake.
He could. But
there's nothing more likely about the paralegal misreading 30 for 60 than the lawyer. I mean, it's different than if I tell my secretary, go read Roe v. Wade and tell me what it holds. Or, you know, a recent Supreme Court case comes down and I say, well, I'm not going to bother reading it. I'm going to have my secretary read it and tell me what it says.
No,
that's delegating something that only a lawyer can do to a non-lawyer, and that is negligent. That is gross negligence.
I think we can all agree
but,
with that.
But reading a number, and particularly, as Justice Sotomayor suggested, I mean, this is somebody who's used to reading numbers in rules and who does this for a living. Is there any indication that the litigation itself made it more likely that an error would occur?
I think any delegation to a non-legal party makes it more likely that an error is going to occur.
What if the lawyer is dyslexic, so he delegates to somebody who knows is a very good... You don't know dyslexic lawyers? And so he says, look, I don't read numbers
don't know,
so good.
What I'm saying is,
I thought
our field of the facts here, we don't have a dyslexic
but may
lawyer.
I ask
we have very
you,
skilled lawyers.
Yeah, may I ask you, what is the proper role of the paralegal then? What is, if you were writing an opinion, what is it permissible to delegate to a paralegal?
I don't think it's permissible to delegate any legal responsibilities. Now, you may delegate...
But what does that mean? What is a legal responsibility versus a non-legal responsibility?
Well, this was a legal question. And any legal question, a paralegal can usually assist you and not necessarily give you legal opinions.
Well, I'd like to... Could you give me an example of a non-legal question that you can ask, other than, is it raining?
Paralegals usually do filing dates, but you usually check them. And
so it's okay for the filing date. So the problem here is that the lawyer didn't check each one?
Well, you have to be responsible for what the paralegal does.
It is responsible.
I can't say to my
He's therapy. Liable for malpractice. I don't get why it matters that the lawyer is responsible for the paralegal's error, because the rule is about... Not whether the lawyer is responsible at all. He is. It's whether the district court can give the lawyer relief for his careless mistake.
Well, if we give relief for paralegals' mistakes, I think that's going to open a very giant door. Because under those circumstances, we can all...
Didn't Congress and the Supreme Court already open the door?
And anything will be... forgivable or excusable.
Can I ask a question?
I don't think that's true. That's not our legal responsibility.
Excuse me. The net consequence here is an additional 30 days in which to ask for a notice of appeal. Does that matter, the fact that there's a 30-day limit on all this to begin with? So unlike some of the other rules in which excusable neglect operates, the stakes here are fairly minor.
They're not minor in the sense of the rule of law. They're not minor in the sense.
Well, the rule of law is that excusable neglect.
What the other cases from this district have said, both reported and non-reported, have all said that in unanimity that you can't say no harm, no foul. So we don't have to worry about legal rules. If we can say if you didn't get harm, let's forgive. Let's not even worry about what the legal rules are. It didn't harm anybody, so it doesn't count. That, almost with absolute unanimity, the cases from this circuit have said that's not true, and I believe that they are absolutely
That's why we're sitting here on bonk to decide whether we were right or wrong. That's why we're sitting here on bonk to decide whether we were right or wrong about that. So
exactly.
The question is,
in making that decision, do we take into account the particular context here, that is, for Rule 4, which in which the total consequence of giving an excuse for neglect is 30 days?
The same thing is true with all of the cases that have been in this circuit and in others. You have to.
Now, under Rule 6, there's no time limit, and under Rule 60B, it's a year. But here we're talking 30 days.
The Rule 4 cases have all been on
that. Well, I understand that, but I'm just asking. To me, it's consequential that all we're talking about is 30 days. In terms of what's excusable, you think a lot more would be excusable when the consequences are fairly little.
There is always a situation in which what is excusable, it's only a certain situation. But the law is a science in which we all have to live. And to say, well, it was only 30 days, or it was only 10 days, or you could have asked for the same relief yourself.
Counsel.
Somewhere we have to have rules.
Yeah. I think we understand. You have used your time. We helped you use it, so we'll give you 2 minutes on rebuttal if you want to use it. You don't have to use it.
I would like to reserve it for that. Okay.
May it please the Court, my name is David Boies, and I represent the Andrews parties. Every time a lawyer makes a mistake like this, obviously the lawyer is responsible. The lawyer may delegate, but the lawyer is ultimately responsible. And every time a lawyer makes a mistake like this, it is discouraging, frustrating, and embarrassing. The issue, though, under Pioneer, and I believe under this circuit's decisions, is not whether it is a mistake, but whether under the balancing test set forth in Pioneer, it represents excusable neglect. And I think there are two issues here. One issue is, can you ever delegate calendaring to a non-lawyer? And second, what happens if that non-lawyer makes a mistake? Here, the non-lawyer...
Why is that even the issue? I mean, why isn't the issue a lawyer made a mistake? I don't care whether he made it by misreading it himself or by relying on someone else who misreads it. The rule could not be clearer. The mistake required skipping over the entire subparagraph A and the entire lead-in clause when the United States or its officer or agency is a party in order to get to 60 days. So I am unaware of any case in any jurisdiction, including ours and including the circuits I mentioned, the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 7th, 8th, and 11th, have all said that when there is a mistake of this sort with respect to this rule that is clear and unambiguous, without anything more, there's no excuse for it.
Well, Your Honor, for example, in the Spicer case in this circuit, in which the court held that there was not excusable neglect. It affirmed a district court finding that there was not excusable neglect.
I understand the use of discretion problem.
But my
point is that everybody who has looked at this precise question of interpreting a clear and unambiguous rule has said that's not excusable. There's always been something more.
Your Honor, I think that that's not accurate.
Okay.
I think that if you look at page 886 of the Spicer opinion, the court is talking there about an attorney's egregious failure to read and follow clear and unambiguous rules. And it says that might sometimes be excusable neglect.
Yes.
And the court goes on the very next page to say, in this case, the Spicer case, where the court finds you had an egregious failure to read and follow clear and unambiguous rules, it says the district court could have decided this either way. It says the district court decided against excusable neglect, and because of the broad discretion given the district court, we're going to affirm that decision.
But is there any circumstance which would be inexcusable under any circumstances? I mean, suppose what had happened here was that the lawyer had not had a calendar clerk, had not looked himself, and had no idea what the rule was and just punted. Would that be inexcusable?
It would be inexcusable, Your Honor. If you had somebody who made no effort and simply ignored it, and one illustration is the unreported case that counsel for the other side cites, the Reynolds against Wagner case, where what you had
That's not a reported case, is it?
It is not a reported case.
We don't want to hear about
okay.
it. Thank you.
Thank you.
But the real question is in how you frame the question, because you say, can you ever delegate calendaring to a non-lawyer? I think the answer is yes, calendaring. But that really begs the real question. Can you delegate the interpretation of Rule 4 to a non-lawyer? And I'm having trouble understanding if a lawyer's failure to read a rule that is as clear as Rule 4 is excusable neglect. I'm not sure what wouldn't be excusable neglect.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, you had a situation in which the calendaring personnel were operating in a system that is widely used in other firms. It is something where the calendar person here was hired from another large firm where he had performed successfully. He was somebody who had performed calendaring functions in the Southern District of New York. It was a system that had been employed and had an unblemished record prior to
Well, it's garbage in, garbage out. In other words, the calendaring clerk comes back to the lawyer and he says, according to FRAP Rule 4, we get 60 days. Well, if you have 60 days, I have 100% confidence in that calendaring system, like my firm, your firm, and many other firms have, that it'll give you 60 days out. The problem is if you tell it 60 days instead of 30 days, it gives you 60 days.
Sure.
That's the non-infallibility of it. But what we have to focus on is the 60 versus the 30, don't we?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, so tell me how it is that this calendaring system is infallible when calendar clerk says to the lawyer, FRAP 4 says 60 days. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the lawyer's obligation to say, oh, FRAP 4, in our case, says 30 days. We're not the government.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that obviously would have been the right thing to do, the proper thing to do,
the
desirable thing
to do.
But what I'm saying is that in this firm and in other firms, the calendaring personnel do not merely take what the lawyer tells them in the calendar.
That is disturbing. I mean, in fact, to me, the hardest part of this case is I would think that a federal litigator shouldn't have to look up anything to know that the time of appeal is 30 days.
Your Honor, I agree with that.
Or the time you read the rule every time.
Yes.
You reread the rule every time. And there's like one fundamental thing on appeal, and it is if you're not the government, you get 30 days. So what I'm having trouble understanding is, you know, we're sort of bouncing this off to this well-trained calendar clerk. But the well-trained calendar clerk at least had the right rule, Rule 4, and says to the lawyer, Rule 4, Why is it then excusable neglect for the lawyer to say, yep, because I'm out of town, I'm busy, you know, just file it, docket it?
Because, Your Honor, first, you had here somebody who had performed this same function, that is, reading the rule and entering the calendar number in other firms successfully, in this firm successfully. And when he was first hired, as the record shows, when he was first hired, they double-checked his work to make sure that he was able to perform that function. He performed it flawlessly.
But he was still making a legal determination. He read the wrong section, the wrong subsection. And the judgment as to whether you pick subsection A or subsection B is a legal judgment. That's not something you can delegate. It's different from misreading a number, right?
Yeah. Although I think you're right, Your Honor, in a sense. Anytime you read a rule, it is in some senses a legal function. But here...
In some sense or in every sense?
Well, Your Honor, it is not a legal function in the sense of making an interpretation. This was not this is a clear and unambiguous rule.
Right.
Because it is a clear...
So it's not like the bankruptcy case where you kind of had to figure it out.
It is not, although this circuit in Bateman and Briones has clearly said that the Pioneer principles apply outside the bankruptcy code.
Sure.
And in Spicer, this Court said that the Pioneer principles apply to an attorney misreading, egregiously misreading, a clear and unambiguous rule.
I mean, I don't think that that's the... I think we all agree that we're going to try to... We're going to decide this under Pioneer. The question is fitting it into Pioneer what it says. Usually it's not. Sometimes it could be. The question is, when you have a circumstance as pristine as this, which is simply the lawyer's failure to read 30 versus 60 days, can that be an excusable neglect? In other words, Judge Reimer talks about these other cases, first, second, eighth, 11th, yeah. Third. Everyone that's considered this says this may be this one circumstance where you don't have a get-out-of-jail-free card. Now, why should the Ninth Circuit take a different position?
But Your Honor, I think with respect, that's not an accurate statement of the Ninth Circuit. Because I think the Ninth Circuit in Bateman...
So we're going to decide this. So I'm asking you, forget what we said before.
Okay, well, if you forget...
forget what we said before. The question is, why should we now take a position that really is at odds with every other circuit that considered it when you have such a pristine situation as this?
Because I think, first, I think you were right when you said it the first time. I think you were right in Briones. I think you were right in Bateman. I think you were right in Spicer. And the reason that you were right is because the Pioneer test makes clear that it is not supposed to be a per se rule. That even in situations where there's a...
Or that there may be situations where you do have a per se rule. I mean, that's what I was trying to find out is that there may be situations that are simply inexcusable and nothing else matters.
Yes, although, Your Honor, what I would say is that that's not a per se rule because what is happening is the district court, in its discretion, is looking at all the circumstances.
Well, suppose a district court in its discretion said, well, I understand that you didn't ask anybody, didn't look up anything, and didn't know anything, and just decided to take a stab that it might be 60 days, but I find that excusable.
I would think you would then have a situation where the district court's abused its discretion. And there can be situations where the district court has abused its discretion. But one of the principles that I think runs through the jurisprudence of all the circuits, not just the Ninth Circuit, but all the circuits, is that this is an abuse of discretion standard.
You abuse your discretion if you make an error of law. And the other circuits have said, in the circumstance where there is a clear and unambiguous rule and nothing more, then if that's not inexcusable, nothing is. Therefore, it's inexcusable.
Your Honor, I don't read the other circuit's opinions as being as clear as the Court does there. And in particular, I think the Court would agree that the 11th Circuit at least
they absolutely agree. Two cases in the 11th Circuit, one of which says exactly what I said in a circumstance where the rule was clear and ambiguous. And in the other case in the 11th Circuit was one where the lawyer got it right and told the secretary to send out a notice or do something that would have been correct, and the secretary goofed up, but the lawyer got it right. So in that circumstance, the 11th Circuit said, well, look, it's sort of an effect beyond the control of the lawyer. He did everything he could do to make it right.
Except, Your Honor.
That's not true here.
No, except, Your Honor, I think that what all of the opinions in the circuit say, and I think what the Pioneer case says, and leaving aside the Ninth Circuit cases just for a moment, is that you have a situation where the question is not whether there is neglect. There's always neglect in these cases. The question is whether it's excusable or not. And here you have a situation in which you look at all of the circumstances, and one of those circumstances is that you had something that was working, had worked, consistently had worked. It was the kind of thing that there was reasonable basis for relying on the fact that this was going to work.
Can you help me with that? You talked about a system. And yet all you really talked about is a person, a non-lawyer paralegal. Is there anything more to this system than just the hiring of a person that you entrusted to calculate these dates?
The record below is pretty much limited to this particular individual. There is some stuff in the record, I think 70 and 71 and 72, that talks about the general calendaring system in which you hire people who do this. They're all experienced. Their purpose is as specialists simply to take the rules and look up the rule for the particular event and write it down. There is a sense in which that's obviously legal work in the sense that you're reading rules, but it is...
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, to me, the clear-cut cases, unlike what's suggested by some of the questions from my colleagues, to me it's an easier question. If it's just sort of misleading, it's like a typo, to me, delegation there strikes me as being... okay. Yeah. You know, somebody, a lawyer can misread the rules as well as anybody else. To me, the hard case is an interpretation case where you've got two subsections. Yes. One says 30, one says 60, and then you need somebody with legal training to figure out which subsection applies. It's not a tough legal question in this case to figure out whether one subsection or another subsection applies, but it is a legal judgment. And legal judgments are not something, I mean, it seems to me that delegating that responsibility to a non-lawyer is inexcusable.
Although in this case, I would submit that the issue between A and B is not a legal issue, it's a factual issue, is the United States a party. And one thing that is clear from the record is that the...
Well, it's an interpretation of the rule. It is. If the rule only had one number in it, and it's like a typo, you know, you read it and you get the number wrong. If you've got two subsections, now you're looking, you have to read the one section, you have to read the other subsection, and make a judgment as to which of the two subsections applies. It's not a difficult judgment, but it's nevertheless a legal judgment. And delegating that kind of thing to me strikes me as a much more questionable practice.
Although I would suggest, Your Honor, that here the only issue of reading is to look at the number and to know whether the United States is a party or not. And here the record is clear that the calendaring professional knew that the United States was not a party.
It's a little more complex than that. How many times have you read a case and sort of missed the key phrase? It's happened to me. I'm sure it must have happened to you at some point. You know, there's sort of the key phrase of... And somehow you read it, you miss it. Yes. And it strikes me that we don't have any findings on this, so maybe it's just speculation, but what strikes me is that the paralegal read the rule and somehow sort of missed the phrase, which is a way in which legal interpretation can get off the track. It's not misreading a number, it's not a typo, it is failing to do a competent reading of a legal provision. And that gets us back to the question of whether reading rules itself is something that a lawyer can delegate.
Although I think that...
It's different from saying, I've looked up the rule, the number is 30, and then the calendaring clerk types in 60. I mean...
And this was not a typographical error in the sense that he saw 30 but typed 60. This is a situation in which, as he says quite candidly in the affidavit that he submitted to the district court, for the first time out of hundreds and hundreds of times of doing this, he simply made a mistake.
Let's say you used him again.
About that, because the mistake, here's what bothers me. Maybe you can help me out. In this perfect calendar system that your firm has, if it had just gone about its merry way and he calendared it for 60 days and he says to the lawyer, not to worry, I'm calendared, you know, that might be one situation, and then we'd wonder, well, did the lawyer make sure he calendared the wrong date? But here we have something additional, and I'm interested to know your take on this. It's not like in the subterranean bowels of New York or elsewhere, Armand, that this assistant has typed in 60. Instead, he actually emails or calls back to the lawyer and he says, Rule 4 says we have 60 days. So it isn't even like he's just off on his merry calendaring system. He advises the lawyer what the rule says. Doesn't that make this case even more distinct in terms of the lawyer's obligation, Mr. Haynes' obligation?
Your Honor, I think that helps in terms of excusable neglect.
Because, in other words, that you should say, oh, well, he read Rule 4, so I don't have to?
No, because what it shows is there was an effort here. I would suggest that the cases that you see in this circuit and other circuits are grappling with two problems. One of those problems is we want to be sure that people take the obligation to comply with the rule seriously. And second, we want to avoid the moral hazard problem of where somebody can, after the fact, come up with an excuse for why they missed a deadline. And it's not the real excuse. And I suggest that if you look at all the cases that you have in this circuit and other circuits, what you see is the courts grappling with how do we deal with those two objectives. Now, one way was the dissent in Pioneer, which was to say we have an absolute per se rule. The Supreme Court in Pioneer says no, and I particularly commend footnote 14 in the Pioneer discussion as to why there's not a per se rule. But if you're not going to have a per se rule, then what the cases since Pioneer have been doing is they've been struggling to find out, well, how do we balance a need to know that these people really took it seriously and it's not a fabricated excuse after the fact.
So what's the effort? Is the effort to read it or the effort to have a calendar clerk?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What's the effort?
The effort is to get it right, to get the right date.
I understand, but in this case, what constitutes the effort?
Well,
having a calendar system or having the calendar clerk email the lawyer, is that the effort?
No.
What is it?
What I would say is the effort is the calendaring system that is set up.
All right.
That one of the things that demonstrates that this is a case where you didn't have a excuse made up after the fact, and that there was an effort to get it right, didn't get it right, and should have gotten it right, but they didn't get it right, but there was an effort to get it right.
Counsel, the effort, if you have a small law firm, solo practitioner, who has no calendaring system because he can't afford it and just doesn't have it, but he does the same thing. He goes and picks up the rule book, looks at it, and makes exactly the same mistake, reads the second paragraph instead of the first one. That's not excusable, or no, it is, because that was an effort.
I think that if he picks it up and makes an effort to do that.
And it's a clear, unambiguous rule.
Right.
He just reads it wrong,
and he's somebody who's been diligent before, who's got it right hundreds of times before, who does all the other things that the district court looked at, then I think that's excusable neglect, too. In other words, I don't think that the fact that you delegate it to a calendaring system insulates you. I don't think it makes you better off.
Okay, so this just comes down to it's excuse equals effort. I go, I pick up the book to read, and that's enough. Is that what we're at?
No, Your Honor, I don't think
it's... Is that the way our bottom line of this opinion is this was not an abuse of discretion because there was effort here, and the effort was to pick up the rule book.
I think it's not just that there was effort. I think that it's the reasonableness of the effort to some extent. I think it is the fact that you had a system that had worked. I think you had a system that had worked in other contexts. I think it is a situation that you tried to go out and hire people who had the right experience to do this. I think it's also, and this is not something that has been in the Ninth Circuit opinions, but it is in the opinions of other circuits, like the Seventh Circuit, in the Robb against Northwestern Railway case that we cite in our papers, where the court says one of the factors that you can take into account is whether these attorneys have gotten it right consistently. That is, whether they have met their deadlines in this case and in other cases. That's
would
one
you have
of the
a less good argument if you were making this a month from now and used the same person and they made another mistake?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's right. I think that if what happens, and we would have a less good argument if this person had made multiple mistakes in the past. I think we would have had a less good argument if this had been simply a person that we had hired, not supervised, not trained, and didn't have a record. I think all of those cases, all those situations would have made it a less good case for us, and that is the reason why I think this is committed to the sound discretion of the trial judge, because the trial judge looks at all of these variety of factors. The thing that a court of appeals will do is to come up with either a safe harbor or a per se rule. And I suggest that under the Pioneer analysis, and particularly footnote 14, and under the analysis, which I think is the right analysis, it's not only what this circuit has done in the past, but I think it's right, when you look at Briones and you look at Bateman and you look at Spicer.
Well, what if the district court had gone the other way after hearing the exact same evidence? Would you lose here on an abuse of discretion?
I think we'd have a very tough argument, Your Honor.
You'd still try.
What?
I bet you you'd still be trying.
We'd still try. We'd still try, Your Honor. But I think as the court ruled in Spicer, in that situation, we'd have a very uphill battle.
Aren't we looking at the wrong level of generality, looking at this rule? Isn't really the question we need to be asking is delegating the reading of rules something that a lawyer can do? I mean, you concede, I'm sure, that there are rules that are ambiguous, and there are rules that you will read and turns out they're not applicable, discovered by something else, or there's case interpretation and so on. And we don't, you know, this lawyer doesn't know what this rule says. If he did, he wouldn't have made the mistake. So what we have is a system in place where a lawyer, without knowing what the rule is and what ambiguities it may contain, relies on the efforts of a non-lawyer to interpret and apply it. Now, it happens in this case, it's a simple mistake, but it could have been a very complex rule, and the lawyer would not be the wiser. He'd be relying on the system.
Yes.
And isn't really, if we deal with the question of delegation, isn't really the issue is delegating on a wholesale basis the interpretation of legal of rules involving deadlines, egregious, more than just negligence, it's egregious malpractice.
If you had a situation where you had a complicated, ambiguous rule, I think you'd
we don't know.
Counsel, I must be missing something. The district court, as I read the district court's order, it did not hold that the neglect that was excusable was the delegation. I don't think the delegation even appears in the order. It said the district court, who's not exactly a novice, said that the missing of the deadline by the lawyer was excusable.
Yes, Your
Honor. Is that wrong?
No, you're exactly right, Your Honor. And I think the district court looked at it the way I think we would look at it, which is to say that what the lawyer did through the clerk was the lawyer's responsibility. And what the district court...
So I don't know why we're talking... Is it your position that this is more excusable because
no.
there was a delegation?
No, Your Honor.
Is it your position that it would be the same result if the lawyer had not delegated and had missed the deadline himself?
By reading it itself, yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that what happened? I mean,
yes.
The clerk says, luckily the clerk gives him the right rule so the lawyer can go right to it. So now what you're having us say is that... given the factors, and we don't weigh them all equally, I think everybody would agree, that a lawyer who doesn't read the rule, and therefore misses the deadline, that is excusable neglect. Is that, I'm trying to figure out how we would write this up.
Well, I think that the reason that I get into the training and the background and the experience of the...
Is that the rule that the lawyer misreading or failure to read a rule is excusable neglect?
No. I think that if the lawyer simply didn't look up the rule at all, didn't yet didn't ask
look up the rule.
And did not ask anyone else to look up the rule.
But the else person
was not a lawyer. So that now gets us back. In other words, see, what we're trying to figure out from the earlier questions is whether the result would be the same with or without the legal assistant. And you were saying, well, it really is the same. But now we're slipping back. So the only way that you can get the lawyer out of the hole, as I understand your argument, is his reliance on the legal assistant.
Since he didn't read the rule himself, yes, Your Honor.
Right. Okay.
He was in a hotel room at the time, right?
Yes. I mean, what I'm saying, when I say the fact that the delegate doesn't get him out of the hole, what I mean is somebody reads the rule. Calendaring personnel or the lawyer reads the rule, and somebody makes a mistake. We're not saying that because the lawyer delegated it to an experienced calendaring professional that gets the lawyer off the hook, that we automatically.
But delegating itself can be a negligence. What if the lawyer says, you know, I'm off vacation in Hawaii, so I'll ask my secretary to draft a brief. She's been with me 20 years. You know, she knows my writing style. She knows how to use Lexis. And, you know, she misses a case. She misses a case. You know, she writes a very good brief, but misses a key case. Surely that delegation, and the lawyer signs the brief when he comes back, or has a secretary sign it for him, misfiles it. That's
malpractice, Your Honor.
Well, it's more than malpractice. That's not excusable neglect, is it?
But
couldn't possibly be.
The only point I would make is that issue, whether merely delegating it was itself takes it outside, was not considered by the district court. I think that if you were to decide that was the critical issue, that just any delegation might make it not excusable, you'd have to send it back.
Yeah.
Because there'd be a whole lot of questions you'd have to look at.
Counsel, your time has expired.
Thank you very much.
Just briefly, if I may, I just would like to read a couple of quotes from Pioneer and Kyle, which I think are dispositive, really, of this issue.
Well, Kyle can't be, because part of our job is to decide whether to
not dispositive,
retain or overrule or limit or distinguish Kyle.
Excuse the word dispositive, instructive. But Pioneer might be. And in Pioneer, they were looking at a bankruptcy form, and the bankruptcy form, the court said, the bankruptcy form 16 contained a dramatic ambiguity which could well have been confused by even persons experienced in bankruptcy. That probably was at least one of the major reasons involved, and I think they said that. But there is no confusion. There can be no confusion as to you have 30
days. Let me ask you about the unambiguous rule issue. Let's suppose the lawyer says it would be negligent for me to delegate. I won't delegate. And he's a very conscientious lawyer. And he gets back from a little trip to Philadelphia that he has to make in the morning, back to the office. He takes some calls from the hospital where his wife is undergoing an emergency procedure. And then he gets back to work. And if he gets around to this case at 2 in the morning, after his fairly demanding day, and he's propping his eyes open, and he just misreads that very plain rule. Inexcusable?
Yes, because that would be, and now I'm going to read again from Pioneer, inadvertence, ignorance of the rules, or mistakes construing the rules do not usually constitute excusable neglect. And under those, even under those circumstances, I would say that is not excusable.
So you think the Supreme Court's use of that word usually was accidental rather than on purpose? I mean, the word usually...
accidental at all.
The word usually implies usually not, sometimes it is. But you're saying usually means never.
No, I didn't say that. I say that a lawyer... one of the first things we learn in law school is the responsibilities of a lawyer. And a lawyer has certain responsibilities himself to do those things himself. And he can't delegate those to a non-lawyer or say, I was tired, or I waited up till 2 in the morning. We would have absolute chaos.
Counsel, your time has expired. Thank you. I think we understand the point you made.
The case is argued is submitted for decision. That concludes the court's argument. And the court stands adjourned.
say